Discussions of dysfunction and addiction usually run along a range of commonly held examples. Violent or otherwise abusive families or individuals are thought of as dysfunctional. People with compulsive, habitual connections to alcohol or other substances are thought to be addicted. I'm Susan McGinnis. On this edition of Conversations, we'll meet a guest who's going to ask us to kind of loosen up our concepts of dysfunction and addiction from their traditional moorings and apply them to some behaviors and habits we think are largely successful. And then we'll move on from there. Join us for Conversations today with Dr. Diane Fassel. Diane, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Check that assumption for me, please. Do we, when we think of addiction, think of, and when we think of dysfunction, think of fairly narrowly defined behaviors? And why do we do that?
Well, I think most of us think of addiction as an addict, and that's a drug and alcohol, a person whose life is unmanageable because of drug and alcohol. And I think that's been the commonly held notion at least for 50 years in the United States. And interestingly enough, in 1988, in the Wall Street Journal, a very unlikely place to be discussing addiction, one of the writers in the Wall Street Journal said, "We'll never be able to win the war on drugs until we're able to deal with the fact that not one of us in this country can get through one day of ordinary life without anesthetizing ourselves in some way. And if we can understand that, we can know how to deal with the war on drugs." And what I think this writer was getting at is that there is a more serious and a more underlying issue here than I'm an alcoholic or you eat too much.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm not the one who's named this problem. Ann Wilson Schaaf really named it in a book called When Society Becomes an Addict. And she said the issue is not just that we are individual addicts or we have individual addictions in our society. The issue is that the whole society operates out of an addictive system. That if you looked at the society, it has the same characteristics that we see in an individual addict. So in an individual addict, you would see the characteristics of their addiction have to do with their denial, their dishonesty, their grandiosity, their self-centeredness, their perfectionism, their crisis orientation. There is a set of characteristics that we see in the addict, not just that I drink too much. It's these characterological things as well.
And you think that this is a societal malaise? Is that what we call it?
Think is that the society itself operates out of denial, dishonesty, grandiosity, self-centeredness, crisis orientation, confusion, that those characteristics are in the society. I also think that the society actively offers us addictions, says to us, wouldn't it be easier for you to be numbed out than to be in touch with what you're feeling? Because I contend that any person who feels what they're feeling in this society either has to die emotionally because it's too horrendous, or you have to change everything that's around you. And so the way the society helps us to adjust is it presents numbness as the norm. Because the numbed citizen is the citizen who doesn't challenge the system. And in the addictive society, the more numb you are, the fewer questions you ask. So addictions serve this society, and we're offered them every day by the society.
Which is why an addiction can be food, drugs, alcohol, work, sex, gambling, things we think of as religion,
sure.
Anything.
Yeah, and in fact, I would contend that these process addictions that you're describing, work, relationships, religion, mm-hmm. things like that, that they are more insidious than the substance addictions, which we've got a concept about the substance addictions, and we can see how our lives and our psychology changes when we take them in. But take addictive relationships, for example. I mean, I think many of us in our society, we believe in the some enchanted evening phenomenon. You know, where I'm in a room and you're in a room and we see each other across the room and there's this immediate attraction, and I think we've all bought into intimacy, and I think that we're essentially putting sex education in the hands of of MTV. Mm-hmm. So those things that are most important to us in terms of our life as a future society, we've now put in the hands of 30-minute sitcoms where we learn about instant intimacy and we solve all of our family problems in short amounts of time.
In 29 minutes with commercial breaks.
Right.
Okay, I want you to ratchet this down a little bit because mm-hmm. we started out saying most people think of addictions and dysfunction as this, and you've said it's not this, it's this huge thing. So show me how it operates in society. You've written a book on addiction to work and addictive organizations. Ann Wilson Chafe has looked at addiction in other areas as well. Pick one, ratchet us down, and show us in brief, in kind of a discussion way, how this addiction as a process works.
Well, let's take workaholism because it's the cleanest of all the addictions, and it's the one that I think we know the least about right now.
Okay, tell me what clean means, though.
Clean means it's the most acceptable.
All right.
It's the most, for example, in my town of Boulder, Colorado, I opened up the newspaper the other day and it said, workaholic chancellor of the university to retire. Mm-hmm. I have never opened up my paper in Boulder and read, drunk chancellor says, I've had enough, or sex-addicted chancellor says, I'm hanging it up, okay? So the reason that workaholism is the cleanest of all the addictions is it's the one we boast about. You don't boast about other addictions. No anorexic bulimic says, I throw up 10 times a day and I'm proud of it.
Right, but I do say I work 70 hours a week and people say, boy,
right,
you're really putting it in. Good. Yeah.
And so let's take this one as an example.
Okay.
Let's look at the fact that in many magazine articles, women are reading articles that say 30 women under 30 who made $1 million. And in that article, we have people described as happy workaholics who run from one activity to the next and have no time with their families or for their own inner life. We go to work and we pick up newsletters, and featured on the front of those newsletters are happy workaholics, where the corporation itself is promoting workaholism. Mm-hmm. We're looking right now in this downsizing environment in the United States, we're looking at people who are terrified about their jobs, and for the first time in this century, we're watching the work week get longer rather than shorter, against all predictions that it was going to do that.
And these are people protecting their jobs.
Of course.
Yeah.
But also, within that same environment, let's look at the role of the organization in it. A lot of organizations today offer stress reduction techniques where you can get your profile, how stressed out you are. Then you're offered examples of what you could do to reduce that, exercise, diet, biofeedback, meditation, so on, all of which work. Then you're told at the end of the session, which is offered to you by the corporation, it's your responsibility to take care of your own health. Mm-hmm. Now, I contend that's a comment which is true and not honest. Honest would be if we took that same laser beam that we've just shed on your individual lifestyle and we moved it over to the management practices of the organization and the culture of the organization itself. And we said, what is it in this culture of this organization that actually is creating the context within which workaholics like this person over here are being rewarded? Until we do that, all we've done over here is adjust the workaholic. We've reduced his or her stress enough that they will continue
they can do
in
more.
This
sure.
scary environment. So it's a many-layered problem. It's not just that your life is out of control over your excessive busyness, rushing, and doing. It's not just that. It's that there's an environment which supports that and, in fact, tells you that you're a wonderful news person or a journalist or a mother or a partner or whatever.
A success if you're doing that,
yeah.
those things.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the question I want to ask. Where does this come from? Is this out of some aspect of the American culture? Is this something that, well, first of all, is this peculiarly American?
Well, I don't know if it's peculiarly American. I do a fair amount of work in Europe, and I have for almost 10 years. And I especially work with Germans. I do most of my work in Germany. And it's interesting to see in Germany that there are 4 weeks of holidays mandated by the German government that every worker must take. There are an extra 2 weeks of religious holidays that come along with that. Mm-hmm. And then most companies offer another 2 weeks. And so the typical German worker has six to eight weeks of vacation.
I think Americans have 2 to 3, roughly.
2 to 3.
Sure.
In addition, in Germany, except in the very large cities, and even in some of those this is true, Saturday at 12 o'clock, everything closes, every store closes, and nothing opens up again until Monday, and trucks have to be off the Autobahn, and people spend a lot of time with their families, making music and doing things like that. But Germany has the highest gross national product in the world right now. So we know that this trade-off, there's no trade-off here about the more you work, the more productive you are. We know that that's a myth, that's not true. But this book, Working Ourselves to Death, has been translated now into German. And it's apparently selling quite well. And so that leads me to feel that workaholism is a big issue in Europe. And of course, we know it is a huge issue in Japan, where the second largest killer of men between the ages of 40 and 52 is Karoshi syndrome, which means death from overwork. Mm-hmm. So we know that Japan is the highest suicide rate in the East right now is in Japan among teenagers.
Right.
So we know that we have societies that surely show a great deal of workaholism. Where it comes from, I'm not sure.
What do you suspect?
Well, I suspect there's something that has to do with a Puritan work ethic that has to do with you are saved by your works. And I think it has to do with our immigrant ethic that has to do with people who come to this country make it through hard work. One of my friends who's a first-generation Italian says that the only way we would have a place in the United States was that we would work, because lazy bums weren't wanted in the United States. Which, this leads me to say that workaholism is not an addiction to your job. Workaholism is an addiction to incessant activity, with the belief that if you were not active, you would have no right to be. So you can do workaholism in your job, but you can do workaholism in bed as well.
That's a remarkable statement. Say it again.
You can do workaholism at your job, and you can also do it in your bed.
No, the other one. I got that. The one before that.
One before that. Workaholism is not an addiction to a job. It is an addiction to incessant activity, with the belief that if you were not constantly active, you would have no right to exist.
That's the extraordinary statement. I mean, I believe what you say about bed, work, relationship, right. Anything else. It is the thing that is remarkable is that you would not have a right to be if you weren't not producing in some way, right? Mm-hmm. Dr. Diane Fassel is our guest today on Conversations. We've been talking about this book, Working Ourselves to Death, which, now let me stop and take a look at the dates, was produced by HarperCollins in 1990. There are several other books. The Addictive Organization is one Diane wrote with Ann Wilson Schaaf. We'll talk a little bit more about Ann Wilson Schaaf to identify her for those for whom this is a new name in a minute or two. Diane's also the author of a book called Growing Up Divorced, A Road to Healing for Adult Children. It came out from Pocket Books in 1991. Diane Fassel is a Harvard graduate, also a graduate of other very good schools in the United States, in English and theology from Webster University. She earned her bachelor's in 1968. Her master's in administration, planning, and social policy came from Harvard, and that in 1974. She earned a PhD from the Union Institute in Cincinnati in organizational development in 1987. We were talking just before we sat down about kind of how Diane's life was transformed by watching how organizations that should have been cured of their ills fell right back into problems some years after she'd finished helping them solve them. And so her life path has changed to one where she's been looking at the problems of process.
That's right.
If we are not whole, unless we are constantly proving ourselves, does this mean that we are all rather dysfunctional in this society? This is kind of a scary question.
Well, it's a scary question, and it's one I feel wary of. There are people in audiences that say to me, you think everybody's an addict, don't you? And I'm not comfortable with absolutes of any kind. And I don't think everyone's an addict. I do think this. I think that it is very difficult to live in our society today, as our society is, without being affected by an addictive and dysfunctional society. I think it's very difficult. And so, do I think everybody's an addict? No. Do I think everybody's affected by the addictive society? Yes. I think everybody is affected by the addictive society in some way.
Can we be healthy in a society that is not?
Oh, yes. And in fact, you know, there's an interesting concept in the 12-step program that was pioneered by AA, and that is you have a disease, you are not your disease. Mm-hmm. You're not a bad person getting good, you're a sick person getting well. There's no issue about your badness or goodness. You're seen as a good person. And you may do bad things when you're in your addiction. And just as that use of the disease concept used widely, I think it's a very rich concept because diseases are contagious. Mm. I think recovery is contagious. I think there's a great deal of recovery going on in the United States, which is changing many things in our country at a very basic level. And it's interesting to note, for example, that right now, according to the National Self-Help Clearinghouse, there are 14 million Americans who are now involved in 550,000 mutual aid self-help groups in this country. That means people mm-hmm. who themselves said, there's something about my life that doesn't work. I see that. You know, others may be saying that to me. I see that something about my life doesn't work. And I want to gather with others who have the same experience where I can honestly talk about this, and I want to begin to change. I don't want to live this way anymore, and I will take responsibility for that. That's the core of the self-help movement. I will take responsibility for my behavior and for doing what I need to do to get better with the help of others.
With the help of others.
With the help of others. That's what's so key. Well, so here we have 14 million Americans who are doing that around this country. Hmm. Surely it was spawned by AA. You know, that's the grandparent of all of these groups. But we're talking about things that go from mothers who had children who were killed by drunk drivers to parents who have physical illnesses of their own or of their children. We're talking about people who had near-death experiences. We're talking about a wide range of people who are changing their own lives. And so that says to me that recovery is contagious.
It's a wonderful phrase, another wonderful phrase. What is it about a self-help group that works? I mean, I could share my concerns with you and you could share your concerns with me and we could sit right there.
My sense is that a self-help group is the experience of ultimate empathy. It is a purely subjective experience. And it does not have, I hope I don't get too esoteric on this. I'm sure you'll do something with me if I do. What I think we've experienced in the technological, highly professionalized helping environment of the United States is that an expert who doesn't have my problem stands outside of me and my problem, listens to me, does a diagnosis of what's wrong, and offers me the solution. And I am not a participant in that process except to give you the information, here's what's wrong. The important shift that happens in the self-help group is that two peers whose only claim to authority is that I listen and share with you my own experience, not with the expectation that it must be yours, only with the expectation that if there's anything in it that you can use, you'll take it, and if there isn't, you'll leave it. Mm-hmm. That we have that interchange, and I then am empowered to make the decisions I need to make and to reach out for the help I need if I choose to do that. And I also have the experience that I have the consequences if I choose not. And it seems to me that that action of subjectivity, of two subjects talking to one another in a participative realm versus subject-object, mm-hmm. one up, one down, that we get in the professional helping community, is so powerful that that experience of empowerment in itself is my first step of recovery.
Does its popularity indicate that it's working? Popularity of self-help indicate that it is a good solution for what ails us?
I would like to think that its popularity means that it's working. I think these groups have been taking a bashing lately. Mm-hmm. There are quite a lot of recovery. There's apparently quite a lot of recovery jokes going on. And although I think it's important to be able to laugh at any of these movements, even they're even in Saturday Night Live now, and they're great segments, you know, on I Have a Disease, and I Went to a Meeting, and showing up in movies. And so that says to me it's having an effect. I think that it's not coincidental that we have an awareness about what's going on in the environment, a huge movement of alternative health care going on next to our traditional MD-centered health care, yes, and the Clinton health plan, and these self-help groups are all emerging at the same time.
Interesting.
I don't think that that's a coincidence.
One more question about self-help groups, and this is an esoteric question, so you can ratchet me down if you want to. But if there is a growing recognition of a problem that affects an entire system, in this case, the culture, does it not make sense that the part of the cure would emerge not out of that culture, but out of an alternative view? That is to say, was his name Bill W., who in the 50s established Alcoholics Anonymous? Mm-hmm. He walked out of himself, his addiction, his culture, to find something that would begin to work, because nothing in his culture was working to help him resolve his problem with alcohol.
Well, it's interesting. See, in the addictive system, which I would say we think of as normal in our society, there is competition, there is one up, one down, there is hide the ways in which you feel weak and don't ask for support and handle it yourself.
Mm.
Okay? And what we find in the self-help movement, which I would say is your walking away from this dominant system, is acknowledge that you acknowledge that you have difficulties does not make you a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
That you can ask for help, and it is frequently there for you. You can take responsibility for your life, and you can move on. That we're in a community here, that it's not one up, one down. That we're all in process around this, and so comparisons don't help. That in itself is a moving away from this dominant system.
And do you think this is a movement?
I think it's a
culture-changing movement?
I think it's a huge culture-changing movement. Remember that there's something now like $70 million a year is being spent on alternative healing, taken right out of people's pockets right now. Is not some of this economic consequence part of the reason we're hearing such rattling in the MD groups these
mm-hmm.
days?
And you would say, fairly frankly, that the system isn't working, the people are recognizing it and seeking to change on their own terms.
Correct.
This is Dr. Diane Fassel. She's talking to us today about what she feels are the ills of the culture that we recognize only individual by individual by individual and say is the responsibility of the individual. We talked a moment ago about Ann Wilson Schaaf. Ann Wilson Schaaf was, actually still is, a therapist who felt that the profession she was in, much like Diane has said about her organizational development skills, were not dealing with the problems at hand. Ann has developed what she defines as a living process. Is it living process therapy? That's not the right word.
No, and actually, Anne would not call herself a therapist. Mm. She, if anything, she would say she's a recovering psychotherapist.
Yeah.
And very deliberately left the field about 8 years ago because she believed that all psychotherapy did was keep people in the addictive system. So the work that she has developed is called living process work.
Living process work.
But psychotherapy,
not at all. With Ann Wilson Schaaf, Diane Fassel has written books on this process. I'll give you a quick list so you know what they are. The Ann Wilson Schaaf latest book, I believe this is her latest, is Beyond Therapy, Beyond Science, A New Model for Healing the Whole Person, where you can certainly find out about her rejection of psychotherapy, by Ann Wilson Schaaf, published out of San Francisco from Harper in 1992, and a much earlier book called When Society Becomes an Addict, and one people think of as the seminal work, which is Women's Reality from some years ago, 1988 or 87, I think.
No, Women's Reality is from 81.
Women's
Reality Reality was 81. When Society Becomes an Addict, 1986. And then, and I'm talking what I think are her seminal books.
Yes.
Women's Reality, When Society Becomes an Addict, and now this one, Beyond Therapy, Beyond Science, which I think is probably her most important book. It came out in 92.
If people want to learn about this kind of process of change as Anne sees it and you sees it, those are the books.
Yes. Right. And especially I would say Beyond Therapy, Beyond Science, because she collects it all in that book and says, here's why we have to walk away from these so-called helping professions.
If people are in a muddle at this point in our conversation,
and any more muddled than you and I are, more muddled than we are,
and want to assess where they are and how they're doing as workers or people in a relationship or consumers or otherwise, how would you say begin to go about that?
I ask myself one question, and the question is there any area in my life where it feels to me that my life is just unmanageable?
That's the word.
Unmanageable. And that whatever I do doesn't seem to help, doesn't make any difference. And when I can be rigorously honest about my answer to that question, it usually opens up to me what it is that I need to be looking at, whether it's an addictive process issue or whether it's a life process issue. But that's the question I ask myself, is where is my life unmanageable?
What do you do?
Shoot myself. Well, what I do...
Oh, thank you.
This is great advice, isn't it?
Dr. Diane Fassel is with us today on Conversations.
And is saying shoot yourself.
Yes.
What I do, because I've had the benefit of knowing about the recovery from addictions, is that I know that whenever anything is unmanageable and it has control of me, I'm no longer in control of my own life, that what I've learned from that 12-step program that was originated in Alcoholics Anonymous is that there has to come a point where I have to say, I cannot handle this anymore. Yeah. Everything I've done doesn't work. I cry uncle. I throw up my hands and I say, uncle, I give up and I need help. And that's the point. I think that's the key point at which I'm in a position now to be helped. So there's a certain act of faith that goes on, and there's a paradox as well. And the paradox is the moment I say, I can't handle this, I need help, in that moment, I do start to handle it.
Yes.
As long as I say, I'm okay, I can handle this, I'll do whatever, I'll take care of this. This is what workaholics say. Their spouses or their partners say to them, I cannot continue to live with you if we're going to have this kind of life where you are not emotionally available anymore to us and our family. Something's got to give here. Every workaholic does what every other person does on December 31st every year. You say, I will handle this. I will take care of it.
As it is.
As it is. And 2 days later, you're doing exactly what you'd done before. Mm-hmm. So there's that moment in which you say, I can't handle this. I give up. I need help. That I think the transformation actually begins.
We're talking today on Conversations about addiction and transformation. This has to be terribly hard for people to accept. At my weakest moment, at the moment where I am most unable to continue on, which is very American, you keep continuing on, right. I'm at a place where I can actually change?
Well, hard for people to accept. On the other hand, I mean, maybe it's easiest for people to understand in this country because we do have a spiritual tradition, many spiritual traditions in this country that talk about there's a force greater than ourselves, whether you call that God or a higher power or Yahweh or however you name this power, that there is a power greater than ourselves that already knows what we need and that all you need to do is to turn your life and your will over to that. And so every religious tradition we have in this country, which is supposedly American, has that at its root.
I would argue that that's not the strongest voice in our culture, which is why I think you assert we're in the muddle.
Maybe one of the reasons we're in such a mess as we are right now.
So if it's a root, it's down there and fairly lean at this point.
Yes. You know, it's very interesting. We were talking before the show about I had just come from Hawaii. You know, white people in Hawaii are called haoles. Mm-hmm. And the derivation of that word is very interesting. For Hawaiians, in the morning, they would go outside and they would greet the Spirit of God outside, and that was called ole, greeting the Spirit of God. When the white people came to Hawaii, the missionaries, they never walked out to the beach and greeted the Spirit of God, and so they were called haole, those who did not go out to greet the Spirit of God. And it finally turned into those who do not have in them the Spirit of God. And so the term haole is certainly nothing to be proud of in Hawaiian. But it's interesting to think that these people who came into that culture already thought that they knew what the Spirit of God was, didn't need to learn from these Hawaiians, mm-hmm. and therefore, in many ways, lost that Spirit. And that may be the story, actually, of the entire colonization effort of this country.
Story of our lives.
Right. There is a politics of addiction. There is.
And that's what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, well, the politics of addiction is that if you do not want people to feel their rage at the society in which they have created, you keep them numb. And an addiction is any substance or process that will take you out of touch with what you feel and what you know.
I'll let that sit there for a minute. I want to move to the other side. You're involved in a project right now called Successful Transformation. You have called it Successful mm-hmm. Transformation. The shortcut to our story is that the Gallup Company called you and said we were contacted by a rescue mission in
Knoxville
that wanted to find out why people are homeless. We turned it around to find out what makes it possible for people to no longer be homeless, their roots. And we found some fascinating things, and we want you to carry it forward. Is that our capsule from there?
That's correct. Yeah. And Gallup discovered that every successfully recovering homeless person, people who had formerly been homeless and were no longer homeless, had 13 life themes that they did not find in people who could not get themselves off the streets and into a home. And we were fascinated with that data, but we thought it might only be within the homeless population. So we said, let's go wider than the homeless. Let's look at people who've had a business failure. Mm. Let's look at people who are recovering from addictions. Let's look at people who have had a life crisis of some kind, whether it's the loss of a love or a divorce or something. And let's look at children at risk in schools and find out, if we looked at this diverse population, would we find that among successfully recovering people, there were the same 13 themes, and we found the same material?
Can I ask you what alerted Gallup that finding 13 themes was remarkable and that they should ask you to go out and probe for those themes?
Well, what alerted Gallup has a business philosophy. It's very interesting. It's their philosophy is go with your success. Don't do things you can't do well. Look for success. So whenever Gallup goes to study a problem, they always study the people who succeed at the problem. That's part of their underlying philosophy. Find what works, always.
Which is why they wouldn't study homeless specifically, no matter what the rescue mission asked them to do.
Right.
All right.
So that led them to saying, let's look at success and what does success look like in transformation. And from that, we expanded the study.
Okay, what does success look like? Let's throw a couple out there.
Well, success looks like there are these 13 themes. And one of them, let me just pull a couple out to give you an idea. One of them is future thinking. That people who are able to successfully transform know that there is a day beyond today and that they can make plans and that they can look forward to something other than what is happening right in this very moment. They're not bound by the circumstances of their life in this moment.
So if we stop to think, put ourselves in the position of someone who is, no matter how we conceive of ourselves, workaholic or homeless or addicted to a substance, that's a major quality. Right. If you can think yourself out of the bottle or the job or the task or your immediate vision of your own self-esteem.
Yeah, and it, okay. And of course it takes you right out of your total self-centeredness that I'm the worst person ever and I can never get better and oh, how bad it is. You can think it's terrible today and there is tomorrow.
Which opens up the world.
Yeah.
Okay, once it's like the Hawaiians who walked outside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Another theme that we saw was the theme, we're calling it the theme of suppression. I'm not comfortable with that word, but that's the word we're using right now.
It's a weighted word, isn't it?
It's very weighted, and I think we have to get rid of it. But suppression in the Gallup study means that you're a person who recognizes that you have problems or you have had problems, but they do not completely encompass your life such that you can't move beyond those particular problems. So it's the recognition that you have this past or you have come from a certain kind of a family or whatever, but it's the knowledge that acknowledging that, you can move forward from there.
I'm not a victim of cancer.
That's right.
Part of this is how we look at it, how we phrase things, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Another theme we found in the study was the theme of self-discipline, that you could put on hold the gratification. You didn't need immediate gratification, that you could look forward. First of all, you could do what was needed to learn a task or a craft or a job, and then you didn't have to have gratification for that right away.
Okay. These first couple are not surprising to me, if I think in terms of what I would define as success.
Mm-hmm.
Were they surprising to you?
No, not at all. What I think we will find is that we're going to see, we keep seeing the same 13 coming in and out of our research. And what we're going to need to look at is whether there's some connection between these particular 13. Why do we keep seeing these same 13 and not five others out there?
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot more to learn.
Okay.
And one that's interesting and somewhat troubling is the theme called predisposition. And what Gallup means by that is that you started from a family background that gave you some grounding in the realization that you are a person and you have worth, and that has carried you through some very difficult times. And the reason I'm fearful about mm-hmm. that particular theme is that I think more and more people are coming from family situations where they don't have a predisposition to know that they have any kind of inner core that they can rely on. And so if we look very heavily to this predisposition theme, it highlights the trauma that the family and all community forms are in right now, because it's not providing much of a grounding for young people in our society. And that theme worries me quite a bit.
Is it troubling because if we pull at that root, successful transformation may be less likely?
I think it's bound to be less likely.
So is that troubling? That's troubling in the largest sense. If we can't keep being successful because of this, we have major cultural problems or major world problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's related to what we were saying earlier. I've just finished reading a paper with a fascinating title, and its title was, "In the 1960s, there was no free love. In the 1990s, there's no free sex."
Yeah.
Oh, actually, not free sex. There's no safe sex. And what I think what this author is saying is that both times were an illusion. In the 60s, there was no such thing as free love. That was our illusion. And of course, in the 90s, we know with AIDS, there is no such thing as safe sex any longer. But but the cultural underpinnings for how people learn about relationships has been given away to the impersonality of the popular media. And so we don't have a place to ground our future generations in the importance of life in all of its forms. And this is troubling in our society.
Even if it's troubling, much like process addictions, isn't it possible that you will just learn more about the culture and how the culture also needs to transform?
In this study on successful transformation?
Yes.
Sure. What we're going to see is we'll see what's going on with individuals who are successfully transforming. we'll also see the culture in contrast, and we'll see the struggles they've had to undergo in order to do this transformation in the face of this culture, which constantly tries to undermine it. But you see, I maybe it is that I'm an optimist at the core, but I think that I think we're learning a lot from these successful transformers. And I love that they're a great cross-section of the country. I mean, they are people who have some of them have the very basest skills you can imagine. None of them went to Harvard. And I'm seeing people who are taking hold of their lives in a way that is truly inspiring, with very few of the supports that you would expect to see people get to do these kinds of things. And so I say there's something roiling around here in mm-hmm. our culture, and we may not even know how to study it yet because it's so in the fabric of the society, but there's no doubt in my mind there's a change coming, and it's not just from the New Agers.
And the organism gropes to live, and once it lives, it gropes to live well, no matter what else is up against it.
I think so.
This is Diane Fassel today on Conversations. When you're talking about underpinnings you feel are slipping away, are there in the list of 13 what you think of as compensatory qualities? If one is weak, are there others that, if strong, can help one towards what is being called successful transformation?
Well, yes, there's an interesting quality. One is it's a quality we call ethics. Probably people would call it morality. And it means, in our study, that people can distinguish between right and wrong. They are responsible for the agreements that they make. They know the difference between lying and not lying. And they also know the difference between being violent and being nonviolent. And that ethical behavior with others is an underpinning for their entire life.
Why does that make for success? I mean, we have in the 80s and also in other eras of our culture, not just most recent, but certainly we've got fairly recent examples of unethical behavior that in some ways drove the culture, drove parts of the economy. What's important about ethics?
What I think is important about ethics is that without a soul, a culture dies. Mm. And ethics is the soul of any organization and certainly the soul of the culture. And I mean this as distinct from religion. I think, unfortunately, that religion has often promised us God and given us the addictive process instead. And hence, many people are very disenchanted with religion. But every organization and certainly every nation has a soul, has to have a soul. And it's that place, I believe, where you are most fully alive and you know intuitively what's right and you do it. And so this ethical issue coming up in the study is very interesting to me because it shows me again that even in the face of tremendous non-ethics that people are presented with all the time, there seems to be this grasping for doing what somebody knows somewhere inside them is right against all sorts of information to the contrary. And so I think without a soul, we perish. And mm-hmm. I'm talking about a collective soul. And I've rarely seen an organization speak. We talk about an organization has to have a mission. It's what you stand for, right, other than we're going to make a lot of money. And anytime an organization gets away from their essential reason for being and they try to do something else or get enamored with something else, they usually fall apart because they're not doing their mission, the thing that they can only do uniquely in the society. Well, societies are the same way. They have a mission. They have a soul. And so when you don't do the soul work of the society, you're always in trouble. And you're in pain. Because I think there's a great void that happens when you don't do what you know intuitively you should be about. It creates a void. And the only thing I think you can do to fill that void is to try to fill it from the outside, and that's what addictions are. Mm-hmm. Just filling up that yawning, gaping hole.
Individually, on the level of the group, on the level of the culture. Do you see all of this as applicable to the microcosm and to the macrocosm?
Oh, yes. I, I, uh, I've been thinking holistically and in terms of the what people call the hologram for a long time, that it's not that we have a little piece and then we have a big piece, because that still puts things into particles. What we have is we have the hologram and the individual person, that the individual person contains the whole, and we have the society, and the society contains the whole, as well as the individual person. So they're both mirrors. In a sense, they're mirrors of the same reality. And that's why we have to watch this victim-perpetrator problem.
Because it takes us outside.
Mm-hmm. It takes us outside. And I think what's happened, I think any dualism will do this. Any dualism will try to static this process of everything is contained in the whole, the whole is contained in the individual, and the individual is contained in the whole. I think as soon as you try to go into a dualism, you try to pull that apart and make it static. It doesn't work.
We do that all the time.
I know.
We do it between men and women. We do it between races. We do it between the haves and the have-nots. We do it between the educated and the uneducated.
Yeah, and the purpose of every dualism is to keep things stuck by going back and forth between the two ends of the dualism. And as long as you do that, you cannot move. You cannot be fully alive. You just stay static. Mm. And therefore, the whole system stays stuck.
This is Dr. Diane Fassel. The project she's working on right now is called, and we assume the book may be called at some point?
I hope so.
Yes.
A Successful Transformation.
Yes.
You never know.
One never knows, right?
We'll
have to go through Harper or Knopf to come back out again. If all this interests you, look at some point in the relatively near future, you probably know.
Probably about a year from now.
Okay. For a book possibly called Successful Transformations. And it's based on the original work done by Question, created by a rescue mission in Knoxville, and then brought to a pollster, and then brought to Diane Fassel for her thinking, research, and work. Well, we have several more characteristics of success, and I think as we're looking at these individuals, these individual characteristics, we're kind of walking around the subject. There's one called woo, and I want to know what that is. It's for people who are listening. It's W-O-O. What is that?
I wish I knew. I've been trying to have them get rid of woo. I keep saying anybody who reads a book that says successful transformation means woo, we're in big trouble. I can just hear what USA Today is going to do with woo.
Not to mention Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. The way I understand woo is that it's an openness to life, and it's an ability to form relationships, to enjoy relationships, not just with humans, but with the environment around you. And it's a way of being in the world which is lively and which engages others and your environment.
This is a verb form, to woo.
Yes, right.
We woo each other, we woo the cat,
yeah,
we woo the job.
Yeah. It's something that these researchers started to use, and they got so attached to it that they can't give it up. And so we have these horrendous battles, and I keep saying, take woo out of there. Nobody knows what it means, and what it means is not what it really is. Uh-huh. So I would think of it as openness to life.
Okay.
That's what I would call it.
What did Gallup ask? What have you asked other people besides the homeless or the recently not homeless in Knoxville to get at these 13?
Well, Gallup is a very astute research organization, and they don't ask anything. First, what they do is they sit down with a group of people, and they say, "We're wanting to study transformation. And do you feel that you're a person who has undergone or experienced any sort of a transformation in your life? And has it been successful for you?" And as people begin to talk about that and say yes, Gallup says to them, "Well, tell us about it. What did it look like? What did it feel like? Mm-hmm. What were the experiences? Give us those in detail." And then they begin to probe through those. So they never enter a study thinking we already know what the characteristics are.
Right.
They always go and gather it through these huge groups that they interview. And then what they do is they sit down with these analysts at Gallup, sit down, and they keep reading these transcripts. Every word is transcribed on tape, and then from the tape put on paper. And they read through these things, documents this big from one person, trying to see, are there any common themes at all? Are there any common themes? And as the common themes start to emerge, they begin to code for those. And as they code for those, they begin to see these common themes. And suddenly they begin to see that they're occurring over every interview that they've done. Mm-hmm. It's out of that that they then form the actual interview document that they use when they go to the telephones to call people all over the country. And so for each one of these 13 themes, they begin to ask people questions about woo or about self-discipline. Mm-hmm. And they would say to you, talk about a time in your life that you felt open to other people in your relationships or whatever. Tell us about that. And so then they start to look to see whether those characteristics are found in your story.
For the cynics in the audience, what are the checks and balances so we know this isn't Gallup self-fulfilling? This is Gallup's belief about success.
Well, part of the checks and balances, of course, in the actual interviews, is that no interviewer ever puts any words in anybody's mouth. They ask the question, they re-ask the same question, and they re-ask the same question. They never even explain the question. And if it can't be answered, they just move on to something else. The other check and balance is that the analyzers who go through all this data and read it, never. They always read each other's work mm-hmm. independently of one another. So you've got two or three people reading the same interview, going off and doing their own analysis, and then coming back and comparing it to another analyst, so that they're checking each other. And let me tell you, there's some great fights over some of the stuff that they look at.
Uh-huh. What's the value of knowing 13 qualities of success?
I ask myself that question all the time. Partly, I ask that question because I abhor techniques. I think that techniques can get us, I think we can begin to trust the technique and not live our own process. And so I have a bit of a fear that the 13 themes will become the 13-step program versus the 12-step program. Mm-hmm. And so I myself maintain a certain cynicism about this. What I think is useful is that we have never known in the United States really how recovery happens among people who are addicts. We know that people experience a crisis in their life. We know that they frequently say they have a spiritual transformation. We know that they get the support of groups. We know that they often work a program in the 12-step tradition. But we don't know necessarily what creates success. And we know that in treatment centers throughout the United States, they only have a recovery rate of 27%. Mm. That means the rest, 63%, go back to drinking or drugging or whatever they were doing.
Does this to you say the recovery programs, the concept of recovery is bumping around in the dark?
In some ways, I think it, like everything else, is in process. And it's never said we're the end all and be all. It just says we try to address addictions. And there are many other issues that come up when you're an addict. A lot of your old feelings, a lot of old issues, whether you experienced incest, all of that comes up in your recovery. The 12-step program has never said it will deal with that, and it's not set up to do that. So there are lots of things that can waylay your recovery. So 13 themes, well, I mean, will they be another kind of a crutch, another technique? And I pray not. What I think they can be is a framework. And I think the way we can use that framework is that we can know some ways that we can support people in becoming more successful. I'm especially interested in it with children at risk in schools. Mm. We can go right away. Here are 13 themes that we see in people in this country from across all kinds of ethnic groups and economic classes, which when they practice these themes, they're happier in their life. They're more successful. And we can teach this kind of thinking. We can develop curriculum mm-hmm. that teaches this kind of thinking. We can create examples of activities in schools that promote these kinds of qualities. Why not do that rather than just go, well, maybe today we'll do an exercise on sharing. Let's all get in a group and talk about a day that it was really hard. I mean, we don't know whether that works or not. All Gallup has done is said, when we go around the country, we find people successfully transforming who look like this. And if it works, use it. If it doesn't, don't.
Build it into Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Kiwanis, Job's Daughters.
See what happens. Uh-huh. I think of it as one tool among many, and I would never say it's the end-all and the be-all. But then, of course, I don't like absolutes. So,
do you see yourself as successful?
Yes.
Do you recognize those themes in your life?
Actually, I do. I was surprised because they're so in me that I don't think, oh, today I'm practicing self-discipline, or today mm-hmm. I've just made a decision out of my ethics. I don't think of it that way. But when I read the characteristics, I go, interesting, I do this.
Yeah, it probably was fairly self-disciplined to get up at X hour or to do this or to stick with it.
And yeah.
Interesting. Is this going to take you somewhere?
I think that this book, it may be my last in this genre.
Cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are a number of reasons for that. I think of this book as a transition book for me. Partly, the self-help genre is one that I'm bored with right now. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm bored with it is that there are several reasons. One reason I'm bored with it is that it's become fairly form-like. Here's the problem.
Yep.
Here are the techniques, solutions, and here's what you need to do to get well. And I've fought with publishers in every book I've ever published because I insist on having a societal component, that we must look at the society and the implications of the society. And I've gotten tired of fighting on this because they say to me, people who pick up a self-help book don't want to think about the society. So take all that out. And so we fight and we fight and we fight, and I say, I'm going to pull the book, and then at the last minute we do it, and mm-hmm. it goes through as I want it. And then when the reviews come in on the books, the only thing that the reviewers like are the sections I wrote on the society.
Yeah.
And then the publisher says, isn't it wonderful we left this in? And I'm going, what? Bloodied, bowed. Right. I'm going, what?
Who are you?
But so there's been that struggle to reflect on the society in a self-help book. Uh-huh. And secondly, there's been my boredom with the genre. Mm-hmm. So I think this book on successful transformation is for me a kind of a transition book to other writing that will not be in this genre.
Okay. What publisher are you working with for Successful Transformations?
I don't know yet.
Don't know. Okay. All right. Look for books already published by Diane Fassel, and you might want to also look for Ann Wilson Schaaf's books and the books that Diane and Ann have done together. From Diane, The Addictive Organization with Ann Wilson Schaaf, published in 1988, Working Ourselves to Death, an incredibly popular book, bestseller, out of HarperCollins in 1990. Growing Up Divorced, if this is a subject that concerns you, the book is subtitled A Road to Healing for Adult Children, published by Pocket Books in 1991, coming out in future. Successful Transformations by Dr. Diane Fassel. The name may change, so just look for Dr. Diane Fassel's name. That one won't. I'm Susan McInnes. We spent a very interesting hour taking a look at addiction, small and large, and success, small and large. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. I hope you join us again next week.